Welcome to Gaia's Consciousness Podcast, expanding your mind and spirit. Learn even more at Gaia.com. Watch interviews, movies, and original series created to empower the evolution of consciousness. For more information, visit GaiaPodcast.com. Your journey begins here.
Our next guest may be familiar to many of you as he's appeared on Gaia's Deep Space and Ancient Civilizations. Billy Carson has spent much of his life digging into things hidden from view, including the origins of our human species, which of course is one of my favorite passions as well, which we're going to get into in a little while. But first, Billy, I want to talk about you, because you were raised in Miami, you're in an African-American household, and you're a total nerd. Okay, so let's talk about your personal journey, how that happened, and how you were perceived by your friends, your family, your teachers. They must have totally loved you, but...
Well, you know, it was a little tough at first. Initially, I was born in New York, in Queens, and then as a young child, age of seven, moved down to Miami, Florida, to a place called Opa-locka. Not the most best
Opa-locka.
Place to...
Yeah, Opa-locka.
Well, it's got its own Wikipedia page, and not for a good reason.
Oh, what is that?
Well, they built a steel gate around the city to keep the crime on the inside. So it's pretty bad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I sleep on the floor at night sometimes, you know, to prevent you from getting shot.
Because of bullets flying through the windows. What the heck? Why did your parents move there?
Well, you know, it was trying to get away from New York and come down here and get a fresh start. But still, we're very extremely poor, and you know. So when you're poor, you just go to wherever you can go, and that was the place that they picked.
It was cheap.
It was cheap. It was easy, and thought it was going to be a fresh start, but it was.
So you saw a fair amount, I assume, in your youth of misfortune.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, there were days when we would just eat Cairo syrup and toast.
Yeah.
That was our meal, you know, and neighbors would come over and sometimes and feed us and things like that. But it was extremely rough. It was not easy, you know. Two pairs of pants. I would dye them. I would bleach them first and then dye them with the 79 cents dye from the grocery store.
Oh, Ritz dye, yeah.
Yeah, Ritz, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I used to do the same.
Hey, you know. So I would just change the color of my pants so it looked like I had different colors.
Yeah.
And I would put cardboard inside the bottom of my shoes because, you know, they were so old that the holes were underneath.
Yeah.
And I'd have to, you know, I was playing sports and everything else, and it was still two sizes too small, but that's what I had to
do. So then I assume the toes burst out. You
toes
got that,
burst
that
out
thing hanging through.
Tore up my knuckles and everything else on my feet. Yeah, it was wild. It was a pretty rough going.
How many siblings did you have?
Three. Yeah.
Three?
Yeah.
And so where did you fall in the birth order?
I was the first. I'm the oldest.
Okay.
And then much, much later, I had a fourth, a brother that was born much later. Mm-hmm. But it was just the three of us initially.
So with literally bullets whizzing by and not enough food in your belly and just seeing a lot of the heavier side of life all around you.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't escape it, but what happened? How did you end up having a fascination with the sciences and becoming a nerd amidst all of that? Because that's not your common trajectory.
No, it's not. I mean, I watched everybody go in different trajectories, but when I was very young, I was, you know, living in this ghetto and seeing people going to the ice cream truck, and I was like, we're all poor, but they've got money to go to the ice cream truck, and I don't. I'm like, how much more poor are we? So I came up with the idea that I would just sell all the little toys that I did have. I said, from this point forward, I don't need toys anymore. I would go door to door, and I would sell toys for 10 cents, 5 cents, a nickel, a penny.
Wow.
Just to have money in my pocket so I can go to the ice cream truck and feel kind of normal.
Yeah.
So I did that, and that's when something clicked inside of me, and I realized that, you know, the key to making money or the key to helping myself and becoming my own savior, well, if I can find a need and fill it. And that was when I learned myself at an early age, like, wow, this is where I need to be doing. I need to be finding ways to help myself and not sit around waiting for help.
So you were obviously extra resourceful.
Mm-hmm.
And you also got a bead on something very early on. A, you have to help yourself.
Yes.
Because no one's going to do it for you.
That's right.
But along the way, did you have certain people that came in, like little mentors or little angels that would kind of show up here and there? Or were you pretty much left to have to find a lot of it on your own?
Unfortunately, I had to find a lot of it on my own, but maybe fortunately as well.
Yeah.
And my dad was pretty strict. You know, he had me doing book reports and reading a lot from an early age. I was already reading books, not like kids' books, but real books at the age of one.
One?
Yeah, age of one, I was already reading real books, novels.
How is that possible? I mean, who fostered this in you? That's impressive. That's protege material, obviously.
One thing I got to give him credit for, you know, of all the other things, was he really impressed upon us to do these book reports every week and read. He would take me out in the middle of the night to these bars to recite the Bible verses to his buddies at the bars and stuff.
How old were you?
I was 1-2 years old.
So you could barely speak?
Yeah, I was speaking very well. I was already walking at 10 months.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. It's almost like if we do have past lives and you had died, you were barely cold and you came in with all your knowledge.
I came in pretty decent. Lit up. Yeah. I had some good brain matter with me when I came back this time.
Wow. That's really impressive. So when you say book reports, this was something that he had you do as a family. It wasn't necessarily correlating with your schoolwork. I mean, this was way before all of that.
Way before all the schoolwork. I mean, by the time I actually got to school in Miami, they just said, you can't go to kindergarten. We got to put you in first grade. You can go to the second if you'd like. And I said yes, but my parents didn't. I just put him in the first. So
because of emotional development and friendships and everything. Yeah. Well, was there anything that stands out when you were really little? Now, this is before you go to school, preschool, where some of the subjects that your dad had you read, for example, actually struck a chord with you?
Well, I started reading a lot of different books about biology.
Biology at 2 and 3 and 4. That's a taskmaster. Come on. It could have at least read some novels
and things like that. Yeah, oh, I did read a novel, and that novel was called, oh my God, it was one of the greatest books I ever read. It was The Sea Wolf.
Okay.
The Sea Wolf was the first novel I read. Yeah, wow, you took me all the way back just now.
Wow. Okay, so how old were you when
Jack
you read
London.
Jack London. How old were you when you read that?
I think I was about 3 years old when I read that novel.
And so what struck you about it, and this is now the art of story, which involves the whole being, which is why I love your story, stories so much.
Yeah. Well, the thing about that was the fact that this man had to go on the ocean, and he was kind of almost in a way kind of alone, kind of like how I was, and he had to face this tide and face this treacherous situation to become the Sea Wolf, and it just really stuck with me, and it gave me the idea and concept of perseverance at a very early age.
Were your siblings as tenacious as you were?
Yeah, my sister and my brother, we all had our unique talents. My sister was a very great athlete. She became, she qualified for the Olympics.
In what sport?
In track.
Uh-huh.
That was in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And then my brother, he was a brilliant mechanic. I saw him literally take a junker that my dad brought home, because my dad was like a backyard mechanic. Mm-hmm. He took a car apart with no training, no nothing, and put it all back together again and turned it on.
So your dad really flipped a lot of good switches in you, even if it was a challenging life. Mm-hmm. What happened to him to make him so demanding of you?
Well, I know his mother passed away when he was 16, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
His dad left to get a pack of cigarettes one day and never came home.
So he was up on his own.
Yeah, he was on his own, So it was rough for him. He had a rough way to go. And he had some issues as well, psychologically, and kind of still does, But I guess in the best way he could, he tried to instill some things in us, and it actually did work.
I love it, because everywhere you look, there's the possibility for instilling something more and hope.
Mm-hmm.
And even in what seemingly look like hopeless environments. And your story is a really beautiful one of perseverance, of bringing knowledge forward and putting the pieces together. So now let's go into the point where you started becoming, even in school, kind of the nerd. And how did that position you in your neighborhood?
Kind of tough. used to have to get in fights every single day at Rainbow Park Elementary.
Why? What happened?
Well, I didn't talk the talk of the people in Florida that had this very southern accent and a lot of slang that I didn't know yet.
Mm-hmm.
Being that I just came from New York, I was speaking more like a New Yorker versus some of the words that they were using. I literally didn't know what they were saying, and they thought I was trying to be bougie or uptight or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I was always seen as an enemy and somebody to fight. So me and my brother would get in fights, and he was very small, even though he was only 1 year younger than me.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would challenge him first, and then he would tell them that I would beat them up, and then
oh boy, the game's on.
Oh my goodness.
So you had a big target on your forehead.
All the time. Yeah, all the time.
Yikes. Okay, so let's talk about how it worked for you scholastically, where you started becoming intrigued with science, ultimately where you became intrigued with ancient civilizations. I mean, all the way now, you've created a space agency and are doing very avant-garde, futuristic work. So where did that part of the journey begin?
Well, when I got to the school, one of the greatest parts of my day was when they would let us go once a week to the library at the school. And that's when I discovered the encyclopedias.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't been looking at any technology, just looking at a lot of the biology and stuff like that. But then one day in my backyard, we live close to the Opa-locka Airport. So I was watching airplanes go over. It's a little private airport down there. And one day when this thing came over, it wasn't an actual airplane. Now, I didn't know about aliens or UFOs or because I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And four channels on the TV, black and white TV, there wasn't anything to make me think about aliens. I just knew it didn't have a fuselage, a cockpit, and wings.
Right.
And I said, what in the world was that? But then it cleared the horizon in seconds, which mm-hmm. is almost impossible for a regular plane to do. I knew that as a kid. It came back and hovered above me, and then it took off the way that it came back in. And mm-hmm. I went straight to the school, and I got all the Encyclopedia Britannicas on aerospace. And that's when I started researching in 1977, Rainbow Park Elementary, every single encyclopedia I can dig down, and started going over everything from the STS to the different submarines to the ballistic missiles. I mean, I learned and studied it from that day. I was just into it heavy.
Do you believe in past lives?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so you probably brought some proclivities forward. Mm-hmm. You must have had, I mean, obviously you had a very scientific brain and your ability to go into such deep inquiry at a young mm-hmm. age.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, so let's say you already had a head start.
Right.
Because you're still a young man now, okay? So where did that take you from there and how did that go through your education? And some of the teachers, you must have been, you know, teacher's pet in more than one case.
Well, it was too easy. I mean, I'll be honest with you.
Sure.
I got bored a lot.
Yeah.
And I would find myself sometimes even helping the teacher teach the class. Getting straight A's was just commonplace.
In your sleep.
Yeah. I came home one day with an A minus. I got an A minus on one of my tests. And because I had never had an A minus before, I came home crying.
Oh.
And my mom goes, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I go, I got an A minus. And she started laughing at me. And I go, I thought I was going to get in trouble for this A minus. That's how, you know, regimented I was with grades. I had no clue that getting less than an A was acceptable.
Right.
So, yes, I was really like a nerd. I mm-hmm. did very well. I excelled in school very easily. Even if I missed days working, because my mom and dad they worked at the Miami Herald delivering newspapers.
You know? Mm-hmm.
And sometimes my mom would be sick, and I would have to go with my dad and deliver newspapers from 3 o'clock in the morning till 8 a.m., and they go straight to school. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes it would be even extended periods during the holidays, and I missed a lot of school. But I would just go and take the tests and pass them, you know, with no problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I scored so high on the ASVAB test that the military came after me for 5 years after graduation.
Yeah, I want to hear about that part, because people like you are always, they become people of interest mm-hmm. to the military and the intelligence industries.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that.
Yeah, back then there wasn't like an SAT or FCAT. That's mm-hmm. something more new. But back then they had something called the ASVAB test, and it would test you for all different aspects of psychology, mathematics, and
looking
physics.
For kind of extraordinary personality traits.
Right. Correct. And they had an eye test too, so I didn't have eye dominance, so that was one of the things. So they wanted me to be a pilot, both the Navy and the Air Force. And I remember even one day just visiting my mom, going to her house to check, see how she was doing, and the phone rings, and she goes, oh, it's the Air Force, they're calling for you. I'm like, how in the world do they know I'm even here? That was wild. And this is in the 1990s. So that was like, that just blew me away.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at this and thinking, first of all, with the kind of scores you had and the kind of brain you had, mm-hmm. intellect, it seems like it's underutilization trying to get you on as a pilot.
Yeah.
Now, what are you, looking back on it,
right.
what do you think was going on there?
Well, now that I've researched a lot of these areas of interest,
yes,
you know, they get you in one way and then they maneuver you to different departments after a while. So they get you in, they really test you out, see what you're all about, and see if they can really, I hate to use the word, but manipulate you into certain areas or ways of thinking, or are you on board with them? Are you going to think the way they think and do what they tell you to do? If you can meet those criteria, then they'll maneuver you into other departments, whether it be, you know, DARPA or top secret departments or, you know, who knows, secret space programs or whatever.
Right. So what happened?
Well, I just kept running from them. I didn't want to be involved in it.
What made you run from them? Did you have an innate sense of knowing?
Well, even at that age, I realized that, in my personal opinion, that there was a lot of suffering going on in the world. And I believe that a lot of the wars that were going on, even back then, were mm-hmm. based off of capitalism.
Yep.
And people in $2,000 suits sending out young people like me to mm-hmm. go die on the front lines. And they were never getting killed. And their kids weren't getting killed. So why would I kill myself for them?
Exactly.
To make a profit.
No, you were very, very wise at a young age.
Yeah.
Okay, so you avoided being entrapped or ensnared mm-hmm. into a lifelong career with the military or
yeah.
intelligence communities, mm-hmm. which you would have obviously been targeted for eventually.
Right.
So then what did you end up doing?
So I ended up going into sales and marketing. And I said, you know, I remember from the early age, sales and marketing was the way, because even when I was 13, I saved up all the money from my newspaper route and I bought electronics. So I knew for a little, everything was going to go from 8-track players to digital radios.
Mm-hmm.
So I invested in it with a company called Galaxy Electronics out of New York, and I started buying these digital radios.
Wait, how old were you?
13.
Okay.
Yeah.
Saw the trends coming, of course.
And it worked out very well. I became one of the largest electronics dealers in the Tri-County area. And I
As a kid,
yeah. And then I had people coming from other counties to buy electronics from me. Everything from EQ boosters to subwoofers and amps and these digital car radios with cassette decks, the high-powered cassette deck. I mean, the whole thing. I still have all my invoices. And I did very well. And then I ended up moving out at the age of 16. So I ran my business, moved out, got myself a car, and got my own apartment and everything, and still graduated from school.
Okay, so what happens after that? We're just moving right on through your life.
I know. After that, you know, I decided, well, the school guidance counselor never interacted with any of us at the school, the high school that I was at. Only this, the very elite of the elite football players. But nobody else got any attention. They were too busy, unfortunately, selling drugs and having sex with the girls at school.
Right.
And that's really what they were
doing. And they got all the attention.
Eventually got busted for what they were doing.
Right.
Some of them, I think, are still locked up right now. Mm-hmm. The athletic director was also one of the biggest drug dealers in the county.
Sadly, not an uncommon story.
Right. So I didn't have any guidance that way as to what I can do collegiately. So I decided to just go out and just, you know, become my own marketing company and do my own thing. And that's literally what I did. So I started working and developing my marketing skills. And I started several little different marketing companies. By the time I got to 1998, I realized that the future was moving into this internet market, even though there's only like 15 or 20 websites at the time. I saw the vision. IBM had a website. Only a few Fortune 500 companies had them.
Right.
But I saw it, and I said, wow, this is incredible. And with synchronicity, a neighbor that lived in my community contacted me and said, you know, he saw me outside a lot, so he said, hey, I know you have this little healthcare marketing company. Would you be interested in letting me make a website for that? And I was like, sure. I was just looking at websites. Mm-hmm. That's the wave of the future. He goes, I'm in college for it. I have to do it as an intern. So he built me a little website, and it literally went viral the weekend that it launched. We sent out only 50,000 emails, and I got 4,000 new customers in one weekend.
I mean, that's like a dream for anyone in today's world.
Oh, my God, because everybody wanted to open email back then.
Yeah.
There was only a few hundred thousand email addresses.
Right.
And so it was phenomenal, and I decided to start my own internet marketing company and do e-commerce and website development. So I literally went to the bookstore. I would read the books at the bookstore, take notes, and come home. I went to Rent-A-Center, and I got a $19.95 a week Packard Bell. I used to call it my Packard from hell because it would crash all the time. 2 gigabyte hard drive on AOL dial-up, and I started making websites myself. And then I came up with a template for mortgage companies, and I realized with mortgage companies, with a service-based industry, I just got to change the colors and some of the text around, and boom, boom, boom. So I would call all of the yellow pages Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, set my appointments up for Friday, Saturday and Sunday, redo the websites, and I was earning six figures doing that.
Oh, my God, and this is 20 years ago. Six figures was a lot of money. Yeah. So you taught yourself code? You taught yourself everything?
I write five coding languages. Yeah.
Billy, you're something else. I mean, I don't know where you came from and what you are, but you are something else.
I've just been blessed, you know, to have a good retention and be able to see, you know, what the future is going to be. Eventually, that company became a multi-million-dollar .com, and that was the name of the company, .com Marketing Group. Uh-huh. And the press releases are still online. I actually ended up getting approached by a company called Globebench System, which was on the pink sheets on the stock market. Mm-hmm. And they needed to catch a cash-rich company to join with them or to emerge so that they can go, you know, bigger with the stock and also then a merger and then sell it. And they ended up selling to they bought me out, and then we ended up selling it to the Amber Alert System. So my initial company, my .com, funded initially the Amber Alert company.
Amber Alert Company. God, this is crazy. Obviously, ice cream trucks were no longer a challenge for you. But how did this go down with your family and the people in your past? Because sometimes you can be either, you know, viewed as a hero or you can be taken down because you're different and you've surpassed everybody else's.
Yeah,
you know.
It gets kind of tough. I mean, because everybody wants something from you and you can't give everything you have. I initially thought I could, and I was giving, and I realized I'm giving away too much now.
Right.
I've still got to survive and live myself, and there's got to be a point where you got to say no. And so when you start saying no, you run into a lot of animosity, hate, and issues and problems and so forth. People are like, why can't you do it? Why can't, you know, you got to realize if I do this for everybody, I have nothing left for myself.
That is a problem of wealth, especially newly created wealth. Yeah. How did it go down with your family?
Well, you know, I've been alienated from some. I stepped back myself. I alienated myself. I stepped back a little bit. And I will only go back for different times of the year and so forth and so on. I help people when I possibly can, especially the closer in, you know, family like your initial family. But it was just, it wasn't that easy, you know. It just, I'll be honest with you, everybody expects me to always, when something happens in a family, like an issue that needs
you're
money.
You're going to pay for it.
I'm going to pay. And it's automatically assumed that would be the case.
Yeah. Okay, so now you're still quite young. Okay, when this buyout happened, how old are you by this time?
In that time, I think I was in my 20s.
You're in your 20s.
Yeah.
Okay, so progress on.
Well, I've had kids. You know, my high school sweetheart, we actually had a kid together. We ended up getting married. We ended up going our separate ways right at the time that all this was happening. Not because of any issues or problems. It just was, you know, it was the right thing to do, so we got together because she got pregnant.
Right.
But I ended up meeting somebody else and getting married again and raising a total of 5 kids.
Okay.
And we lived a very, you know, very good life. I've done things with them that, you know, I never could have done as my own kid, as a kid myself, I would say. And I mean, I remember waking them up in the middle of the, you know, like a Saturday morning and saying, hey, just get up, get dressed. We're going to get on the plane. Don't break any clothes. We'll buy clothes when we get there.
Oh, my gosh. Every little kid's dream.
Oh, yeah. You know, we'll just fly to Busch Gardens or fly to the Bahamas or whatever. And so they had a really good life. You know, I was heavily involved with them. I took 7 years off and I just invested all my time and energy into coaching, which is why I became known as Coach Billy.
Oh, that's wonderful.
All the volunteers, all their schools, all the sporting programs, AAU, eventually from AAU even to the U.S. Junior Olympics.
Love it.
Team USA coach. I'm still a registered Team USA coach right now.
So you really gave them everything that every child would love to have.
Yes.
By way of encouragement, opportunity, even resources.
Everything.
They had it all.
They had it all. They knew that they couldn't screw up because I was going to be right there at their school anyway, volunteering.
Right.
So, I mean, I was everywhere they went. You know, even at the YMCA, I helped fund the YMCA in West Broward so they would have a facility to play at.
Yeah.
So when you walk in there, my name is on the giant granite wall as a founding member.
Yeah.
The rock climbing wall room. I really gave back a lot. And then I put a lot of energy into helping underprivileged children get the opportunity to go to college and play sports. And through that effort, it was almost $12 million in funding for college scholarships for girls basketball.
God, good for you.
Thank you.
Now we start moving toward where you are at this moment. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So then, you know, through all of that, I was still doing my research. And
did you stay intrigued with the notion of flying devices that didn't appear to be anything of Earth origin? So that remained a peak interest of yours.
Yeah, absolutely, nonstop. I mean, I had telescopes and everything else. And I was always looking for these things to come back. And I didn't see any until recently. But during that process, unfortunately, the wife that I had at the time, they, you know, it scared her. And I can understand. It's the stuff that I was really into.
It's outside the box.
It's outside the box. And it's not the average, you know, thing. So
did you have people from agencies or anything kind of tracking you or watching you during this time, or had you gone off the radar?
I think I was off the radar.
Okay.
If they were, I didn't know about it.
Okay, just checking in there.
Yeah.
Okay.
But what happened was when I did build this website called Survive Pole Shift, because I really, after doing a lot of research, I came to the conclusion that we had pole shifts in the past. This is why Antarctica is where it's at and why animals still have undigested food in their bellies. And I came to the conclusion that we were going to have another one probably within the next 200 years or so. So I started researching that very heavily, and I made a website about it, and that kept getting hacked down. And then I started a mobile app development company around that time, and the app was getting taken down from Apple and also from, at that time, Android. It wasn't Google Play yet. And they couldn't give me any answers why that was happening. So I backed off of that for a little while, and I just kept doing my own private research for a few more years, you know, and just keeping it under wraps. But it definitely affected my relationship. Between that and all the coaching, it was just like, she didn't have enough, you know, QT.
Right, right, exactly.
So we ended up going our separate ways, but after the kids were already in college and everything else.
Right.
You know.
Oh, so the whole thing about the pole shift, were you looking at it from the point of view of magnetic field shifts?
Not the magnetic field, so to speak, even though that does happen. Mm-hmm. It's happening right now as we speak.
Right, it is. So where were you basically tapping into it?
I was realizing that the crust of the Earth, it shifts and it locks together. At these points, and then at certain times, depending on the gravitational forces, especially if there's another gravitational body in our solar system or close by our sun, which I thought was probably called this nemesis object, and the Enumerilish is called, you know, it's a brown dwarf star. And I discovered that, in my opinion, it was really out there based on some of the watching of the precession of the equinoxes and realizing our sun was speeding up in precession. So why would our sun speed up? That raised a big question in my mind. Mm-hmm. So I started researching, if our sun is speeding up, it's got to have, he's doing it for breakaway speed. Mm-hmm. And that's when I came to the conclusion early on that we must be orbiting another star, but how come we can't see it? So I started researching that and found out that there are red dwarfs and brown dwarfs, which now my theories that I wrote about all these years have just now been verified because the
sun is in a binary star.
We're in a binary star
companionship
system.
With yes. another star.
It's been verified now.
Now, okay, so Walter Cruttendon, mm-hmm. you know, had his conferences for years, and that mm-hmm. was his passion.
Oh, wow.
He was an amateur, but a good one, astrophysicist. Mm-hmm. And that was what the hypothesis he had for many years. Mm. But he actually, at one point, went so far, I don't know where he is on this now, so far as to say he felt that the binary companion was the star Sirius.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's why it kept coming up in ancient, particularly Egyptian, mm-hmm. not mythology, but
right.
history.
It's possible it's a trinary, but the one that I discovered has now been labeled Biden.
Biden.
And it's just outside.
No, like Joe Biden?
Yeah, I know.
Seriously, okay.
Yeah.
All right, Biden.
Very weird. But if you look
does
it up,
he know this?
I think he does by now. They made a whole thing about it on the news, and they brought an astrophysicist, and he showed the location of this object, and he said it's a solar system in our solar system, and it's just outside the orbit of Pluto, but inside the Oort cloud. And he said, and then he says, this is the crazy, it's on my YouTube channel, he says, this is where we came from. That's his exact words. He said, we're seeing this is where we came from. So I was like, wow.
That gave birth to this solar system. That would mean that our sun was newer, theoretically.
Yeah, right, possibly our sun was, or that was a captured.
Or captured.
Captured brown dwarf.
Okay.
Something that was, because that happens a lot. You have these rogue planets
so
and rogue
suns.
So
let's talk about the implication of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think not all, but a lot of our viewers have heard of the precession of the equinox. We've had mm-hmm. lots of guests on through the years, but mm-hmm. what is the implication of being in a binary star system where your solar, yeah. where your sun is a binary star?
Well, the implication is that you're going to have at different times during this solar cycle where you're going to have more gravitational waves coming through your solar system. And this is what's happening now. So the global warming, it's not just an effect of cows passing gas and exhaust from your car. It's also from these gravitational waves that are emanating from this other brown dwarf as it gets closer to our sun, and it's coming through the entire, and that all, every planet and moon in our solar system right now is experiencing global warming, every single one. Mars is, the ice caps are melting. Saturn's core is melting. Scientists said that if we were there, we'd be dead already. All the ice caps are melting everywhere. Io is having more geysers than ever.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that's happening from gravitational waves because energy in, you know, it's just like the same, you know, the old saying, equals MC squared. That energy's coming in, it's going to magnify, it's going to vibrate. And as those suns and moons orbit their solar bodies, they're also going to expand and contract, and that's going to cause more friction. So now you're multiplying that with these gravitational waves, which is going to then heat up the planet and cause other calamities and catastrophes if we were there. Now, here on Earth, we're talking about more tornadoes, bigger and stronger hurricanes, mudslides, torrential rains. Everything we're seeing right now.
Gaia.com lets you explore over 8,000 films, documentaries, and original series.
There's so much going on in the unseen world.
Hidden truth.
Why in the media today? They still seem to hold back on these incredible stories.
Behind an unknown universe.
Where science and spirituality all come together.
Gaia.com. Content you can't find anywhere else. For more information, visit GaiaPodcast.com.
Greg Braden said it well in the show that he's here on Gaia,
mm-hmm.
where he's talking about the ice cores.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the ice cores, you can see different times when
yes.
this object has affected our solar system and caused these global warming cycles. And it's there in ice cores, and it's happening every 4,200 years or so, just as the astrophysicist said on the network about the actual orbit of this particular object.
Interesting. And actually, for me, it was Greg Braden back in the early 90s and reading his, I think it was called Zero Point, that first little kind of glued together book called Zero Point, which talked about the magnetic field and the dissipation of the magnetic field at this period of time. That has serious implications for every life form on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk to that? Because I don't think most people understand. Greg stopped talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can.
Yeah.
and it's like this invisible elephant in the room that
right.
no one talks about. I think we need to talk about it. This affects the way our brains function.
Mm-hmm.
It affects our immune system. It affects plants and trees and animals. Please tell us what happens when you have a reduction in the magnetic field to life
forms. Well, it affects your circadian rhythm. You're talking about genetically modifying your DNA in a way. People don't realize that magnetic fields flow in and throughout your entire body and interact with your DNA on a daily basis, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So when it starts to change and reduce or increase, then the DNA responds in different ways. It can cause different things like bad replication. It can cause tumors. It can cause memory loss, believe it or not, because a lot of memories are stored in DNA. And it's already been proven that magnetics have an effect on stored memory, which is why we went away from VHS tapes. VHS tapes were getting erased by the magnetic field of the Earth. And that's why we moved
to CDs. See, that's a part that nobody tells you about.
Right, yeah.
And I find it absolutely fascinating. At one point, I was told that because the mind is very dependent on a stable magnetic field, mm-hmm. that what we would start seeing, and I'm not saying this to scare anybody, mm-hmm. I'm saying let's just, you know, be aware, do mm-hmm. what you can. You have a wonderful little device here. There are things we can do. That the human species would start going through kind of almost en masse memory loss, mm-hmm. and then moving towards something that almost looks more like insanity of sorts.
Yeah. It's almost like, you see the old movies with the people walking around like they're drones or they're, you know. But what happens is literally is in our brains are millions or actually billions of magnetite crystals.
Yes.
And they interact with the magnetic field. Now, we've been kind of disconnected from really and feeling that sensation because of our what I call our junk DNA, which was done about 200,000 years ago. We'll get into that later.
Yes, do.
But what happens is we still interact with that magnetic field with those magnetite crystals that are in our brains mm-hmm. on a consistent basis, and it gives us a stabilization. You know, we used to be able to use it to navigate the planet, mm-hmm. just like birds
just
and
like
turtles
birds,
and everything else. But we've kind of been, but we still, it's still a vital part of the human psyche. And when you throw that off, then all of a sudden you can have things like psychosis, bipolarism,
yes.
all these different
which
things
we're seeing
come out
everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This is becoming common.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, we look to point fingers as to where it's coming from. We look to the obvious things like, well, it's the vaccines, it's food mm-hmm. sources, it's EMFs, mm-hmm. radio frequencies, and so
right.
forth. But it's actually something that's the underpinnings even beneath that.
Yep, absolutely. And this is where you're going to have like you could have potentially like a zombie apocalypse happening. Which mm-hmm. is kind of what you see happening with some of the psychosis that's going on the planet right now. And a lot of people are just be given more drugs, but they're not treating the real problem.
So, Billy, I mean, this is something that I've been interested in and mm-hmm. concerned about for a long time because no one knows it's happening.
Right. yeah.
And we're all pointing our fingers at each other and
right.
and I think in the wrong places. Not that those other things, you know, can't exacerbate the problem,
mm-hmm.
but let's talk about what you do when you're in a diminished magnetic atmosphere mm-hmm. so we can protect our
yeah.
brains, our everything.
Right. Well, you know, technologically, we've had to make adjustments because magnetic north has moved from true north down to Russia right now.
Yes.
And they've even had to renumber the their airport runways so that planes can know where to land,
mm-hmm.
just how powerful this is. But what we can do as a species is we need to first dig in deep to ourselves. We have to get into more focused. We have to be able to meditate more. I think meditation is really key. Different types of meditations as well. There's different meditations for different types of things. There's meditations for manifestation
mm-hmm.
of things into your life.
Mm-hmm.
There's meditation to reduce the amount of input into your mind and let the cosmic energy fill you
mm-hmm.
so that you can get more insight and understanding. And there's also a meditation for health as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we need to focus on more meditations. I think there's really key and it will give us a stabilization factor on our bodies. And as well as the other thing is eating better. We're getting poison everywhere we turn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's almost like, what can I eat anymore?
Mm-hmm.
But we really have to emphasize and put more focus in on that and reduce the amount of poison we're taking in.
Right.
Because we're just compounding the problem.
Absolutely.
And I think that's one of the biggest issues we have.
I think these are both really big issues. But also, you have various people inventing little devices, even medallions mm-hmm. and such that you can wear that supposedly hold a stable magnetic field just
right.
immediately surrounding the body.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about some of those and what their true value may or may not be? Or
yeah. Well, there's some EMF protectors
yeah.
and so forth. You know, this is like the flower of life made mm-hmm. out of pure silver. Those things have been proven, like under real experiments, to actually reduce the EMFs.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it will work, but, you know.
What about pumping up the magnetic field taking it into a little higher range, at least surrounding your own personal body.
Well, that's the thing that, you know, I use those in the, like in the back of my cell phone. I have one of those protectors. Anything I can to reduce the amount of exposure that I'm getting. But one thing that I do is a lot of people don't realize is we all have chi energy. And I actually envision my chi energy coming out of my body, out of my head, splitting around and encasing my entire body. And I literally walk around like that for the day. And when I feel it getting low, I do it again. Now, it may sound like something crazy to some people.
No, it doesn't at all. Not to this audience.
Okay, not to this audience. But, I mean, I've only had 8 colds in my entire life.
Wow.
And I attribute that to my chi energy because when people sneeze and cough around me, I feel like it hits my outside shield and it bounces off. And I've coached children and kids and been around schools and everything else. And everybody's always sick, but I only had 8 colds in my entire life.
So when did you discover this and how long have you been employing that practice?
One day, somebody sneezed by me. And it got on me, the actual sneeze got on me. I was like, the saliva, and I was like, oh, my God. And at that moment, this was about 30 years ago, and that's a very long time ago, and I realized I was like a teenager, and I think I was, just in my 20s. And I said to myself, if I can make a force field around myself to prevent that from happening, that would be great. I just thought it. And I said, let me just try it in my own mind. And I literally tried it, and I felt like it worked. I felt something literally coming out of my head and working. So I said, well, I'm just going to do it from this point forward. Now, whether it's working or not, I don't know, but I can just tell you that for me, hardly ever being sick, coaching unlimited amounts of games and being around so many children, you know, they're sneezing and coughing and bringing in germs in all the time, 24/7, traveling around the entire world. I've been around the world twice to all these countries and everything else and not getting sick all the time. I attribute it to that. I just have to say that's probably, you know, what it was for me. That's just what I feel it was.
Ah, thank you for sharing that. Okay, so now let's go. And you teased us a little bit ago. Junk DNA, which is just, to me, is just such a joke.
Yeah.
You know, you're somehow born with 95% junk DNA.
Right.
Yeah, right. So let's go back now into the story. And this takes us back toward, you know, like you said, a couple hundred thousand years ago. Not the beginning, but...
Yeah.
Ancient enough times that that's where our story became corrupted. And let's start talking about that.
Yeah, I really do feel like the existing hominid that was on this planet long before we got here as Homo sapiens sapien was some other type of hominid, probably our cousins. And according to a lot of the ancient texts, around 200,000 years ago, they began to genetically modify these existing hominids. There's been a little bit of a misleading thing going on in some of the ancient community and some of the truth-seeking community where they think that these Anunnaki or these Atlanteans created human beings.
No.
That's not accurate.
That's not accurate.
Yeah. We were already here.
Yeah.
They decided to genetically modify and manipulate us to work for them and do their bidding, basically. So around, you know, modern-day biologists and scientists have discovered that some of these modifications to the human body, to the Homo sapiens sapien, happened around 200,000 years ago. Ironically, the same amount of time that, you know, the Enumeration, the Seven Steps of Creation, the Atreides epic, the Epic of Gilgamesh, all these different epics that you read from these ancient Sumerian tablets, they start to talk about this happening around that time. Even the modification of chromosome number 2 and the addition of these telomeres that basically shrink on chromosome number 2, that's all about 200,000 years ago as well.
Telomeres, did they used to not shrink?
They used to not shrink. They used to do, they would, but at a very slow pace.
Instead, now they're shrinking and breaking off to the extent where our lifespan is limited to less than 100 years.
Exactly.
That didn't used to be the case.
Not the case. People were living for thousands of years
indeed.
Back then. It's documented.
Yes.
And even what happened was during the Tower of Babel incident, which is written about in the Bible, what copied from the ancient Sumerian tablets, Enlil, who's known as Yahweh in the modern day Bible, came back and saw it and realized, oh my God, human beings can achieve anything they want. And it actually says that in the Bible. If they can achieve anything they set their minds to, he said, my seed shall not abide in man forever. His years will be 120. And that's when the genetic modification occurred. And that's when I believe that the chromosome number 2 was altered and that reduced our lifespan time.
Okay, let's just take a moment here because we're going to go tangential for a sec. At that statement and that discovery, the understanding was that the human being that already existed here on this planet had incredible creative manifesting capabilities.
Yes. Absolutely. Already just as good as qualified as they were to become a spacefaring race. He realized it at that moment. So what did he do? He destroyed the Tower of Babel. Now, in the Bible, it's God. They say it's God, but it's really this Enlil character who did it. It was copied from the ancient tablets. He destroyed it, and then he split the people up, put them around different parts of the planet, and changed the languages.
Right.
So that they couldn't communicate and work together anymore. Made us enemies of each other. So brother fighting brother, so that we can't realize who the true enemy was.
And this has gone on since then. Let me just then kind of go on another little track for a moment. When you look at the Aboriginals in Africa, in Australia, for example, they have not lost that ability to navigate and communicate and be part of the cosmos. Mm-hmm. Those capabilities we all once had. It seems like they were exempt from the manipulations.
Yeah, I talked to some of the Aboriginal elders.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go visit there actually more this
winter. Oh, tell
us
about this.
Yeah, because
it's giving us a glimpse of what we once were.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. I mean, their story is they're from the Pleiadian star cluster. Mm-hmm. They were seated here by Pleiadians. Mm-hmm. This is their handed down verbal history. They truly believe it. They have a lot of extraordinary capabilities, extrasensory perception that the average person just doesn't have. They still have
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
And there's a place down there called Nkariong 9 in Australia where there's a partially uncovered Egyptian temple where the Egyptians would go there and to visit and learn from the Aboriginals.
Because they hadn't been tampered with.
Exactly. That was the main reason why. They were pure. And they would sit with the elders, they would go for walkabouts, they would learn directly from them, and they would write about this in this temple, which is etched into stone, and then they would go back to Egypt.
Do you know of any other groups of people around this planet that were untampered with? And was that just simply a matter of location, geography?
Yeah,
they just
know.
Didn't bother, they didn't show up there?
Yeah, it's a hard place to get to, but I don't know of any others in particular.
I don't either.
They're
just
really, really unique, and their story, the fact that they're saying that they're from the Pleiades.
Yes.
That's amazing to me, and that they were the first seeded people on this planet.
Well, the last show I just did was with a man named Jason Quitt, who started having dreams and coming in contact with a pharaonic line, Egyptian, passing knowledge on, that was said to have originated from the Pleiades through Atlantis, down into Egypt, captured in stone in Egypt for us to resurrect today. Mm-hmm. Again, the same Pleiadian introduction of this knowledge. Or actually, I think it was more to remind us, help us remember what we were once capable of. And this is part of the story that just really ticks me off, that we were tampered with in this way. So you carry on the story now.
Yeah, we've basically been mind wiped. And there's a movie that I'm working on called Chronicles of the Anunnaki, and the opening scene is in the Pleiadian star cluster with a galactic war between the Lyrians and the Sirians.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really do believe that there was a galactic war there, and that what happened was the refugees from the remnants of whoever survived left out of there, went to the Orion, went to Sirius, and some might have crash landed on this Nibiru planet, which is talked about in the Enuma-Elish, which was eventually captured by our solar system with this brown dwarf star. And this is why you have ancient accounts of these Anunnaki people or these Atlanteans coming from different star systems. It's, you know, it's always specific star systems, and the Great Pyramid is aligned with these specific star systems, and I believe for a couple of reasons. One is because that's where they came from, and also that the Great Pyramid is probably a communications device, that through those shafts, through some type of subspace frequency, they would be in direct contact with whoever was on those planets.
I do believe that that's at least in part what they were, because they were created by them for them, essentially, right? They're not for humans, per se.
No,
right. Except perhaps a few of the unique pharaohs, which also have these bloodlines of star people.
Right.
So the human being was tampered with then. We're moving the story forward into where it becomes of interest again in reintroduction into modern society today. Why is this happening now? Why are we remembering? Why are we waking up? Why are we beginning to tell these stories to each other again?
Well, you know, something amazing about DNA, it has an amazing storage capacity. 1 gram of DNA, which is enough to put a tiny drop on the tip of your finger, can store 433 petabytes of data.
Wow.
Absolute zeros and ones data. So what happened was this scientist named George Church, he actually created an e-book, and he then downloaded the e-book to the DNA, and he said, this is incredible. It can take downloads from a server and upload back to the server again. That's when he realized this is a digital, you know, binary code. He said, let me replicate the book as many times as I can. They replicated it, I think, 80 million times or 80 billion times, some ridiculous number. And that's when I said, this is outrageous. And I had been talking about DNA being used as hard drive for 10 years.
Yes.
And now Microsoft finally did it. They just came out, I think, about 3 or 4 months ago, they announced a DNA storage drive.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that part. This is my understanding, too, that when we start considering incarnation patterns, that it is tied in through the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very practical reason for that,
for
being to continue coming back into that familiar DNA pattern.
Right.
So let's talk about some of that.
Yeah, well, see, DNA is not only can be plugged in, but it's also wireless.
Right.
So the beautiful thing about it is the fact that it can send and receive information wirelessly. It's already scientifically proven. And so as information comes into the DNA and it's downloaded into the DNA, it's stored there. Mm-hmm. And as you pass from generation to generation, some of that makes it into the next generation. And I think that through the mind wiping that we went through and through some of the genetic modifications, there was a diminishing of some of that information, but it was always locked in there and stored.
Yes.
And now it's coming back free again. It's found its way back into the genome, found its way back into the core where we can tap into it. And a lot of people are all over the world are starting to wake up, and some of these ancient remnant memories are coming back to us.
Yes.
Even when people say, oh, I got an idea to do this or got an idea or an invention, that stuff was already just in your DNA.
Right.
And you just tapped into the information and unlocked it again.
Yes, you know. I love this, and I absolutely agree with it. So let's maybe extend the conversation now to what happened that is allowing us at this point in history. Mm-hmm. I mean, because if you're looking at the phenomena of these gravitational waves, mm-hmm. right, you've got the phenomena of the Earth's own frequency shifting, the magnetic mm-hmm. field dropping, yep. got a lot going on at one time. Where in this whole mix do we little human beings start, like, suddenly flowering again?
I know, right?
Among the insanity that's also cropping up.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's amazing because in the Emerald Tablets, Thoth talks about the fact that he wrote these tablets for a new human being birthed under a new sun, which is us in this day and age. And I think what he was referring to was the fact around 2012, which I knew was never going to be the end of the world, just another phase shift, our solar system, which undulates up and down the galactic equator mm-hmm. every so many tens of thousands of years. Well, we reached the center of we're still hovering at the center of the galactic equator, which means the majority of the cosmic rays and energy coming from the galactic center is emanating right into us, through us, and all into our DNA, into our brains and everything. And the fact that the magnetic field has diminished, it's allowing all that to come in even more. So now we're absorbing more of this cosmic energy directly from the galactic center, from the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. And it's coming into us and altering our DNA, reviving us, waking us up, reconnecting strands, and letting us realize and remember who we truly are.
Absolutely. I'm so happy to have you say this. Many years ago, I was in a conversation with a physicist named Mark Cummings, who is actually Russell Targ's son-in-law. Mm. And he was saying, the black hole, Regina, it's a plenum. It's a plenum. All of the information is pouring through the black holes. It's not just something that sucks the life out of everything. So tell us of black holes. Tell us the story of black holes from that perspective.
Well, listen, black holes store everything. They used to think that when you went into a black hole, you would be disintegrated and you would just die and that was the end of that.
No. Mm-mm.
Black holes take information and store the information on the event horizon. And now because of that, we discovered that everything in the third dimension is always stored. Nothing, energy can't be destroyed, it can only be transformed. And black holes are like data portals. They hold googles of information on the event horizon. And then because of the irradiation that they emit, which Stephen Hawking realized and told everybody about, that actually has these bursts of these X-rays and radiation that goes out and sends that information back out into the universe as these different rays, which interact with our body, interact with our DNA, and put information directly into us. And this is what a lot of people don't know about.
Talk about the event horizon for those who don't understand that.
Well, the event horizon is the part of the black hole right before you get to this part where, you know, light can't even escape.
Right.
And on that horizon.
And it becomes into the visible spectrum, so to speak.
It becomes the visible spectrum because.
At the event horizon.
Yeah, as it's absorbing and as it's gravitationally pulling everything in, it heats up. Mm-hmm. So it lights up. This is how we can see black holes because of the event horizon. If it wasn't for that, we wouldn't even know they existed.
There'd be no contrast.
Exactly.
Right.
So that just gives us the contrast and we go, okay, well, this is where the edge of the black hole. As a matter of fact, stars that orbit close spin so fast around it, you know, that they probably, if you were there, you'd probably be experiencing some type of a time dilation. Mm-hmm. But this event horizon, as things cross over, it takes the information from wherever the object is and breaks it down and stores that information directly on the horizon, and nothing really goes down and becomes, this to the finite point and disintegrates.
Right.
You know, so
it's, stored there. Mm-hmm. So it's this plenum of information that can burst forth these waves of information, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And are you saying that this binary star or even trinary star system and the position we're in at the galactic center, having them closer to each other and these gravitational waves are what's allowing the transference of this data from the black hole into our beings, planet, our species?
That's exactly what's happening. See, as this other brown dwarf gets closer, it's bending our magnetic field and warping in a weird way. This is, anybody can look this up and look at the science data. It's the magnetic field is available online for anybody to look at. You can see how it's warped and bent. And so that diminishing bending and twisting of the magnetic field, as it's getting ready probably to do some type of a flip, at the same exact time that we're at the galactic equator, it's a great time to be alive.
Well, I was just going to say, it is wild, it's chaotic, it's scary, and it's so exciting.
Yes. Yeah. We're like the pioneers of a whole new wave that's going to happen, a whole new type of Homo sapien that's moving forward into the future, a whole new evolution of the species right now.
I agree with that. And at the same time, we notice that so many people are dropping off, dropping away, suffering, dying young, going crazy at the effect where you're not managing those energies, where you're not able to take them in a stabilizing and healthful manner, because it's not stable. None of this is stable.
Right.
And so how philosophically do you look at this, and would you share how we might all look at it, because so many can't hang with it, and others are going to thrive, and it's just the way it is.
It's the only part of evolution that I truly agree with, is what's happening is some people are able to handle this amount, massive amount of information and data input, and some people aren't. And nature is weeding out the weaker ones, or the ones that haven't been able to grasp it or hold on to it and are struggling with it. And the ones that make it through are the stronger ones. It's just like mating animals or genetically modifying plants to be a stronger tree or whatever. It's a part of nature, and stronger people are making it to the top, or then they're going to have babies, and they'll become. So it's almost like a new human species coming out of a human species.
And I was shown once upon a time a few years ago that in this new human species that's arriving, you were talking about food a little while ago, and we were looking at cosmic influences. And one of the simple things I was shown is that part of the reason our digestive systems are atrophying is because we're moving out of the sources, eating these kind of dense, these dense foods, low frequency foods, into a vehicle that's much more efficient, that the body is going to be living more on, you know, chlorophyll type of liquid diet in the future.
Yeah.
So I mean, say have all the croissants now you can.
That's right.
Because they're going away.
You know, when I talk a lot about the fact that, you know, spacefaring civilizations probably move towards a more of a plant-based diet.
That's what I saw, and liquid and green in particular.
It just
where
makes
you're getting
sense.
This interaction with the cosmos and the sun and the earth and the herbs and so forth.
Right. It's just logical. Yeah. It's just a logical next step. I mean, even if you look at it from a technology standpoint, you can't afford, in space, energy is like prime. You can't divert energy to storing and keeping meat frozen.
Yeah, no.
You can't do it. It doesn't make any logical sense. I mean, and it doesn't, you know, just even as us not being, you know, out there right now in the stars, we just know that that doesn't make any sense. We're not going to, on the Apollo 11, they didn't have a meat locker. Okay.
Right, so, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, in Michio Kaku's world, you have these levels of civilization, type 1, type 2, type 3, and so forth. And so I think he said we're like type half.
Zero.
Zero type, moving into one.
Yeah.
How what is your view on that? Mm-hmm. Because you're part of this, and your kids are part of it, and a lot of us are part of this this explosion of knowledge and trying to hang with it and move forward and thrive in it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's really an exciting time, like I was saying before. And, you know, analyzing Nikolai Kardashev's work in terms of, he was an astrophysicist and a scientist from Russia who came up with this Kardashev scale. And right now, we're kind of like a type 0.5 civilization, where we're just now starting to realize, oh, we can't just take all the resources out of the planet and never replenish them. We can't just destroy everything around us, you know. Unfortunately, like we have the Amazon burning now, so people can grow cattle and things like that. Well, a lot of us are starting to realize that we can't continue on this path. That something has to change. So we're at that point where we're realizing we're waking up, going, "Uh-oh, this ain't right. We got to figure something out here." And eventually, there'll be enough conscious souls on the planet that we'll be collectively able to stop and halt what's going on. A type one civilization is more of a planetary civilization, which is where we're moving into, where we begin to harness the power and the energy of the planet. We live in resonance, human resonant frequency with the planet. We're a green society. We're not destroying and just taking all the resources and destroying the planet. We're living in complete resonance with it. We found a way to tap into different energies that don't destroy the planet. And you can, this planet can house 20 billion people without even a problem.
I have made this argument so many times. And there was a woman who showed me this one particular graph that if you were living in harmony with nature, you could essentially put all the people on a little hectare of land in the state of Texas and you'd be okay.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's plenty of room for people if we were intelligent and living in companionship with our Earth.
Exactly. And it just takes the fact of us consciously making the decision to do it. That's it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree with that. Yeah. And now you're doing your part. So let's talk about your space agency a little bit. And I mean, people, I think you've already been on a number of shows at Gaia. Yeah. So people can check out Billy Carson on a search in the Gaia bar and find you all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
But let's talk about your company, the space agency, what you're doing, because you're really starting to look at bringing forward for real. We've all heard about the prototypes for the last 30 years. But bringing forward for real technology such as perpetual motion. Okay.
Yes.
Right. So tell us what you're up to.
Yeah, sure. In 2014, I filed for a company called First Class Space Agency in the state of Florida. Initially, my thought was, how can I directly affect human beings on this planet and help them? But by utilizing monies from what I thought was going to be the future of private space, which ended up being that. So mm-hmm. I saw that vision again.
Mm-hmm. And before I said, Elon Musk or, yeah.
Around that time, trying to get it going. You know, I think he was running, just getting out of PayPal at the time or something started. But I was like, you know what, I got to find a way to tap into this, and I can utilize that revenue to create technologies for space, but that also will benefit mankind. Because technologies I had learned through my research over the many years, that they always trickle back down to humanity. Some of it, not all of it, you know, they keep some tucked away, some of the good stuff. But, you know, cell phones were originally military. You know, a lot of technologies that we've done and medicines we've developed in space, and then they come back here to Earth. So I said, if I can develop generators that can go to third world countries like India and mm-hmm. Nigeria and other places and give them the capability of having electricity and power, that would be great. And plus it can be used for space and I can get money and funding for that mm-hmm. very easily. So that's why I did it. I didn't realize how hard it was going to be to get the approval from the, you know, the attorneys and the NATO and ESA. And
right.
It took a lot of money and a lot of years, but I finally got it all done. I'm approved with NATO. I'm registered with the European Space Agency as a vendor. I'm registered with NASA as a vendor. I'm registered with the Pentagon and approved. I could submit proposals
and get
contracts.
Well, that's persistence.
A lot.
Oh, my God. Okay.
It was a lot.
So let's talk about hydrogen. Mm-hmm. Because years ago, I remember I was doing an environmental report in the early 90s, and I was reporting on, I think it was a BMW conversion to hydrogen, mm-hmm. and it was functioning.
Oh,
squashed,
yeah.
Went away, never heard anything about it again.
They have a few of those that have come out.
Yeah.
But now is really the time. Everybody's starting to get away from the fossil fuels and realizing we've got to make some changes on this planet. So now is really the time. I'm coming at the right time with this. And we're working on hydrogen generators, which are not new.
Right. But have you perfected it somehow?
Yeah.
Made it more stable?
Yeah. There's a
very
unique
unstable.
Process.
Yeah.
Very unstable. There's and a little bit, not too wasteful, but not mm-hmm. as much power output. But there's a very specific technique, which I can't go into, obviously, because it's really kind of top secret. But a form of electrolysis that we're using with a different type of filter that allows us to get the hydrogen atoms separated from the oxygen a lot more efficiently and mm-hmm. pushed over into another chamber for combustion. And the only emission is steam. And so it's completely green.
Yeah. So this is something that could be applied even down to the automotive industry,
mm-hmm.
not
Absolutely.
Just the space industry.
Not just the space, anywhere. Yeah,
because
anything.
That's kind of been the holy grail, people waiting for hydrogen.
Right, exactly.
Because you don't have to plug into anything.
Yeah, and if you're in a spaceship, you know, a lot of these asteroids are loaded with billions of tons of water.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're out in deep space and you want fresh water and also power, you can just tap into an existing asteroid that's already out there with water,
right.
convert that into power, right. and have water as well.
We're out of time,
oh,
and we've
no.
just barely
oh,
wound
no.
up. I can't tell you how much fun it has been getting to know you,
you
know, and
you.
What you've been up to and how you feel, and the whole notion that you're excited about this crazy period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I am too.
Yeah.
I don't see our future as dim. I see it as brightening.
Yes.
You know, we might have some wobbles to pass through. Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts before we sign off?
I just want to tell people that, you know, no matter what you're going through in life, you can always excel. You can always persevere. You just have to make a conscious decision to do it.
Yes.
Put action behind that and focus on it. Meditate on it. Think about it. Speak it. Speak it into existence. And it will happen for you.
You are the poster man for that.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Billy. Whew. Okay, so you can go to Billy's site, Forbidden Knowledge. That's a four, biddenknowledge.com. It offers loads of articles and insights in the ancient mysteries and all the other things we've been talking about here. You can also check him out on the search bar on Gaia on all the other shows he's appeared on here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Gaia's Consciousness Podcast. Learn even more at Gaia.com and watch interviews, movies, and original series, all to empower the evolution of consciousness. For more information, visit GaiaPodcast.com. Gaia. Watch. Belong. Transform.